few guys have come up and told me that this is very good. Both Barry and I more or less have to take for granted that you have read chapter 23, is it, of the culture of Western Europe, because that will help you a great deal. And that if you are in doubt about Kant and Hegel, you read about it in the culture of Western Europe. I am not so naive that I have an idea that there's nobody in the world who hasn't heard of Kant or Hegel. After all, I spent a couple of weeks on Tahiti this summer, and thank God nobody had heard of Kant or Hegel. That's all I needed. But the question is, I do have to assume it for you to at least some extent, yes? Because I can't start at the beginning. The beginning in this case is actually 513, of course, which comes before. But all of this can be made up if you read about Kant and Hegel in the culture of Western Europe. And if you're not sure, then why don't you look these things up in the Encyclopedia Britannica or in any encyclopedia, I don't really care, make sure that you know. Because the fact is very simple, as I told you last time, that those young socialists who wanted to break out of the iron cage, as they call it, the iron cage of dogmatism, which is exemplified by your Kautsky reading, the iron cage that leaves no room for human volition, that seems to be totally materialistic, deterministic, totally mechanical, as it were, scientific, Darwinistic, whatever you call it, that those people went back to Kant or Hegel. Because as young Germans, or young Hungarians, or young Central Europeans, as even Frenchmen in some cases, they knew that these were the great inspirations for philosophy of the 19th century. And being the great inspirations of philosophy for the 19th century, they thought, not incorrectly, that to break out of Kautsky, you have to link Marx and philosophy again. All these alternatives, all these breakouts, which I'm talking about now, you can subsume under the heading of trying to link Marxism and philosophy, where Friedrich Engels and his disciple Karl Kautsky had linked Marx and Darwin. So instead of linking Marx and science, these people wanted to link Marx and philosophy. And philosophy for them meant two things. It meant Kant, because they were concerned with ethical standards. They were concerned with eternal ethical standards. They wanted a piece of eternity they could appropriate. It wasn't enough for them to say that the good society will be in the future. They believe that the means do affect the end, as you will see, and that meant believing in the goodness of man, not just in his reason, Marxism. This meant believing in the Kantian categorical imperative. And they went to Hegel for another reason. They went to Hegel because Hegel stresses history as a process, and as a particular process in which man's consciousness interacts with reality. And so, as they wanted to make more room, they obviously went to Hegel because of this interrelationship between man's consciousness with reality. And they believed that, unlike Marx, the Marxists had forgotten Kant and Hegel, and therefore they had forgotten both the human element in Marxism the human element in socialism and the ethical element in socialism. And socialism had become a mechanical, scientific, historical theory in which the proletariat was inevitably the bringer of the new society, and in which tactics played a large role with the dictatorship that must follow the victory of the proletariat. Now, all of this we must clearly understand. The proletariat, therefore, was not virtuous because it is the proletariat. For Trotsky, for Engels, a certain amount to Marx, the proletariat is virtuous by the very fact that it stands outside the corruption of capitalism, that it is not corrupted by capitalism because it stands outside it. Not so. That isn't enough. Instead, the proletariat must also do what is right and ethical. And this, in a sense, as you will see, or realize, or understand perhaps, broadens the idea of the proletariat. So that, in effect, you can say the proletariat is more than a class idea. It is an idea to which everybody can belong, provided he exemplifies the class struggle together with the ethical dimension, provided he is willing to lead in the class struggle. Remember, that's always there. But to lead as an ethical person, a person who is not willing to use tactics, a person who wants to love the neighbor himself. This was summed up, as I told you last time, in Kurt Eisner's essay, Marx and Kant, of Kurt Eisner's essay, Marx and Kant, in 1904. And as I tell you, Eisner himself never had to face the problem of revolution, because he had good luck. The revolution he made in Bavaria in 1918 was, I think, the only spontaneous revolution that has ever existed. That is to say, as I told you, he addressed a large crowd on a meadow in Munich. The crowd was so fired by his speech that it simply went and occupied the government building. And Eisner had a revolution almost without knowing it, quite without wanting it, certainly without knowing what to do with it. But as I said, he was even taken, that responsibility was taken off him, because he was assassinated only 3 months, 2 months later. And the revolution became a Bolshevik revolution. Now what you have, therefore, is also as a consequence, of course, that there must be no oppression after the revolution. That the whole revolutionary process is, in a sense, both an anti-capitalist and an ethical process. That to have the dictatorship of the proletariat means, of course, that the revolution means oppression. And to these people like Eisner and others, that was certainly anti-revolutionary. There is a strong idealism here, which should be clear to you. Now, to be sure, this idealism above all inspired writers, literature, rather than revolutionaries. Because it raises, after all, an interesting question which will preoccupy literature, socialist literature, from now on. What does the good revolutionary leader do with the counter-revolution? What does he do with it after the revolution? Or, to put it another way, what is this revolutionary leadership? In a very famous book, the writer Leonard Frank, for example, one of the most famous between-war German writers, Leonard Frank, published a book called Man is Good. And typically enough, in 1952, he published another book entitled Left is Where the Heart Is. And you see the exaggeration of this kind of idealism. Man is good to left is where the heart is. Man is Good is a series of short stories which simply mean that revolutionary leadership is running through the streets and saying, man is good, and that will activate everybody's categorical imperative, and everybody else will run into the street and say, man is good, and overthrow the government. That's exactly what many of us student revolutionaries thought in the 1960s, by the way. So, in other words, what you have therefore here is the exaggeration of this, detaching. But usually it is not detached. It is part of the class struggle. But in literature, as with Leonard Funk and others, it tends to be detached. The most famous novel which poses this problem, out of the war, after the war, is by another leading German writer, Leon Feuchtwanger. And it is called, I think it also exists in translation, Thomas Wendt, which is just a name, and it brings it home to you. Thomas Wendt, 1918, is a young revolutionary who needs a successful revolution without having to use tactics, just like Eisler in Bavaria. He becomes the leader. He brings about a new society of freedom. But what happens after the revolution? After the revolution, after all, the counter-revolution becomes active. And how does he deal with the counter-revolutionary? The answer is, of course, he is unable to deal with it. And his revolution fails. As Thomas Wendt says, you will always have to use force against men if you want to eradicate their ideas. You must be unjust to be just. But I am not able to be unjust to be just, because for me, the means determine the end. So here in Feuchtwanger's Thomas Wendt, you have the kind of dilemma. And the dilemma of the Kantian revolutionary. It was Eisner's dilemma. It was the dilemma of this whole attempt to break open Marxism in this particular manner. Marx and Kant and Marx and Hegel. What do you do with the counter-revolution? When in 1932, a young man asked another very famous German socialist writer, Berlin. When a young man in 1932, out of the agony of his soul, the Nazis before the door, asked Berlin, should I join the socialist party, one of the socialist parties, to fight Nazism? Berlin's answer was, it is necessary, above all, to fight for humanity. In other words, there is here a kind of optimism which grows out of the Kantian view of man's ethical possibilities, combined, as it were, with the Hegelian idea that the ethical man must interact with history in order to bring about the classless society. As I have said to you before, these people wanted to be the conscience of the working class. As Leonard Frank writes in The Man is Good, if you can read it translated, one only needs to love, then no shot will fall. Then there is peace. The whole continent cries for love. It must have the capacity to love. Be ready to love. In other words, make love, not war. Dates back, actually, to this book, you know, this slogan. Make love, not war. Because the idea behind it is, of course, again, the ones I have told you about. Let me summarize it in the most famous place, which really came out of all this. and perhaps the most famous and lasting German writer, who of a greater fame than Germany, who was a Kantian socialist. Now Toller himself joined the Bavarian Revolution. In fact, by the way, there's something, I don't know why it occurs to me, before Moshe Dayan, he was the only other modern Jew ever to have won a battle, the Battle of Dachau. He led the troops of the Bavarian Revolution against those who tried to suppress them and won that battle in the suburb of Dachau. Didn't make much difference. But anyway, Toller joined the revolution. He was imprisoned afterwards. He finally committed suicide in New York in 1939. But he wrote a famous play in 1921 called Mars Men. Masse Mensch. Mars Men. And the idea of that play reaffirms what I have said. If I demand the life of a single individual, it would be wrong. The only taking of life that is permitted is self-sacrifice. No man may kill another because of a cause. Unholy is the cause which demands this, which commands the spilling of human blood. That is the Moloch, that is the abomination of the Old Testament. You don't know what the Moloch is. The state is the Moloch. God is the Moloch. The masses are the Moloch. Now what you have here, therefore, is again this idea of the sacredness of the individual. Our power is greater than their might. And the individual is sacred because he has within him the categorical imperative. This does not deny the class struggle. It does not deny the necessity of the abolition of capitalism. It does, in fact, not deny the necessity of revolution. It believes in the necessity of revolution. But it must be a revolution without the taking of life. It must be a revolution based then on this idea of goodness, on this idea, if you like, of both the respect for humanity due to your neighbor as you would done to yourself, what we call the Kantian categorical imperative. And at the same time, it must be a revolution made by those who realize the evil of capitalism, which has corrupted everything, including ethics, who are willing to lead the class struggle, but who lead it as Thomas Wendt led it. That is to say, through an ethical example. And therefore, who fulfill in a sense what Hegel had believed, that progress in history is the interaction of human consciousness with historical reality. Both of these things are believed. Now, to be sure, a great many of these Kantian socialists, let's call them for a minute, took place in the Bavarian Revolution. The other one, and I just mentioned his name because he has become again quite famous and very appealing figure, was in fact killed by the counter revolutionaries Gustav Landauer. Gustav Landauer was killed by the counter revolutionaries. Gustav Landauer combined this with a kind of anarchism. He believed that the classless or ideal society is a society of small groups. He was one of the few who followed through the Proudhon idea of small groups in Germany. Now, about all of these men, there is something that I want to summarize. Yes, there's one passage that I still want to read you from Toller's play, Mars Men, which I think sort of sums it up very well. The masses are not sacred. Violence created the masses. Injustice of property created the masses. The mass springs from misery. It is a cruel revenge. it is a blind slate. It can therefore not be Kautsky's proletariat. The mass itself is evil. The mass itself is not a good product of capitalism, but an evil product of capitalism. That is very good. The masses are not sacred. Violence created the masses. Injustice of property created the masses. The mass springs from misery. Its cruel revenge is a blind slave. May it occur to you about all of these names that they are all Jews. And about this, I must now say something. For it is totally true that the attempt to break out of this orthodoxy was led, and to a certain extent, in fact, coterminous with young Jews. The reason for that, because when I talk about Bloch, the Jew, when I talk about Lukács, is the same. All of these people I'm talking about are young Jews before the First World War. The reason for this is, I think, and not very difficult to fathom. It is, first of all, that it gave them a place in the labor movement. That is no unduly cynical saying. But they wanted a part of the labor movement. They wanted to lead the class struggle. But they were always outsiders, as Jews, obviously bourgeois, from bourgeois homes. There are no working class Jews in Central or Western Europe of this nature. They're pretty bourgeois Jews, but they are no working class Jews. So they were stigmatized as bourgeois always by the very fact that they were Jews, because there is no Jewish working class. So what you have therefore is that they still wanted to lead in the masses. So this gave them a place as the conscience of the working class. A place in the working class. And as that, they were resented. A famous speech I told you by August Babel in 92 about the pushy Jews, the intellectuals, and Jew became coterminous. In the socialist movement, is the first movement where intellectual and Jew becomes the same thing. And these terms, intellectual and Jew, come bound up with troublemakers. In other words, the kind of idea that the regents of the University of Wisconsin have now started in the socialist movement, that they don't know. Then here, this became coterminous. Intellectual, Jew, and troublemaker. Because of these young Jewish socialists who spearheaded the attack on Orthodox. Because they had to make contact with the working classes, and that for a Jew is still today, I think, almost impossible that I should be attacked on that. Impossible and ridiculous. But never mind. Secondly, it is quite clear, secondly, that in a sense it gave them an emancipation. It was really the fulfillment of emancipation, because here the young Jews had the same in common with Martin Buber. In fact, Buber is the great friend of Landauer, and Buber's famous book on Paths to Utopia is all about that. That is to say, they typify a more general Jewish ideal, the ideal of humanity in general, because if you stress humanity, then that leads for a complete emancipation. If the important thing is not whether you are a German or a Frenchman or a proletarian, but whether you have an ethical imperative within you, then there is no question of emancipation. Then you are emancipated. Then everything else does not matter. So that you get this idea, not only on the young Jews, you get it very strong in Martin Buber, you get it very strong in that whole Jewish generation. You get it very strong in early Zionism, that Jewish nationalism is only a path to humanity. That was one of the trends of Zionism as well. And the reason is clear. It is a complete emancipation. You can forget your origins. Origins do not matter. Stereotypes that do not matter, so that you have here is special. And at times, it is in fact mixed with a kind of messianism. For if we have talked about the Kantian socialist, I must say a word about another one who tried to escape, who just died 3 years ago. By the way, knocking to pieces Mosse's law. Mosse's law is that if you are a racist or a fascist, you lived in 88-89. It's quite a true law because we made it seem rather cognate to die in 88. And that's your best ticket for a long life. I don't know why, the theological question of it is done. So, what you have here, however, that Ernst Bloch, this is true for some reason, Ernst Bloch is another one. And he, in a sense, combines things. And it is very typical for Ernst Bloch that after the war, he taught for a while in communist East Germany, and then, of course, he fled. Because communist East Germany is, in a sense, Kautsky writ large. Now, what Bloch wanted to do, he wanted to restore an apocalyptical, messianic fervor to Marxism. His idea was that Marxism had lost its revolutionary fervor. How can you restore revolutionary fervor if Kautsky dominates and if you just wait around? So you must restore revolutionary fervor by linking not Marx and philosophy, but rather by linking Marxism and the old Jewish, if you like, Christian, messianic, apocalyptical tradition. Philosophy must take off where Marx ends, in utopia. What Marxism needs is a new sense of what he calls the red dawn of the apocalypse, the thing which is not yet, the thing which will be. Or to put it better, Bloch believed that capitalism was so evil and so corrupt that in fact the present is a nothingness. The present is so insignificant that it is totally transparent. There are shadows of Hegel here as well to go into that. But anyhow, capitalism leads to a nothingness. The present is transparent. The present is an expression of insignificance. And therefore, what is important is not the corrupt capitalist present. It is so evil that it's really nothing. What we must wait for is the hope of redemption. In other words, capitalism is so evil that what must come is redemption. And that induces into, through the class struggle, careful to say this again, through the mechanism of the class struggle, through the mechanism of the nationalizing of the goods of production, through the mechanism. But what Bloch introduces here is the rhythm of Christianity, really, in order to revive Marxism. Christians would say that the present is so bad because of original sin that our hope is redemption through Christ. Bloch puts it differently. Capitalism has made the present so bad that our hope is redemption. His most famous book, therefore, is a book about a radical reformer of the 16th century who had the same idea, who started a peasant revolt, Thomas Münzer. And Bloch's book on Thomas Münzer, 1921, right after the war, exalts this prophet, that's what he was, who thought Luther was conservative, Luther was the Kautsky of his day. To him, Luther was like Kautsky, and Thomas Münzer took off, aroused the peasant, and in a sense led the peasant revolt of 1525, in which he was killed, because he believed the peasant was so evil, so corrupt, that redemption must come about through struggle, through war, through revolution. Now, that was Rothbard's, in a way, a contribution out of the iron cage of dogma. And therefore, his most important book, a book that is still much read today, is called The Principle of Hope. A three-volume, really, examination of European culture, of all of European culture, on the idea of hope, under the aspect of redemption, of hope, of this rhythm. Now clearly, Bloch is, in a way, a transitory figure. It's not possible to found a movement on the idea of the apocalypse. It's not really possible to found a church on Bloch, but not really a socialist movement, though, as I said, class struggle and the classless society are there in Bloch's ideas. The third, whom I want to talk about, is perhaps, in the end, more important than even the other two. Because he is still in the center of modern Marxist dialogue, of modern Marxist debate. Georg Lukács is not very far removed, in a sense, from the Kantian socialism. Georg Lukács, mind you, as the name tells you, was of course a Hungarian. But his culture, his language was German. By the way, I would make more of a thing of it if I taught in Jerusalem instead of in Madison. But everybody who is a part of a small nationality with an obscure language has to write in a language people know, yes? So Lukács and intellectuals in Hungary, by and large, were part of German culture, as most of intellectuals in Eastern Europe, yes? And they wrote not Hungarian or Slovak or whatever, they wrote in German. It's only later that nationalism becomes so dense. So when I say Lukács is in Hungary, I mean he's really a part of German culture. In German. If he had written in Hungarian, my dear, nobody would have known about him, would because who reads Hungarian? So remember, it's very important what language you write in, people can read you, yes? Otherwise, it's everybody is excluded. Now, Lukács is more difficult, and yet he touches in both. On the one hand, he believes, like the Kantians, in an ethical revolution. On the other hand, he wants to revive the revolutionary interest. The Lukács, who is important for us, is the young Lukács, not the old Lukács. The book that is crucial and still alive, and which is in fact, you can have it in English as well, is History and Class Consciousness. A book that is published in 1922. You see, all this revival, gestating before the First World War, bursting into flame after the war. History and Class Consciousness. And when we talk about Lukács, we talk about that book. Why? Because later on, Lukács became a Stalinist. Later on, he believed that he had to keep in contact with the working classes. And that could only be done through the Communist Party, he may have a point. And so he became a Stalinist, and he wrote the most dreadful nonsense. But he was an uneasy Stalinist. Lukács had office in Hungary twice. Once in the first Hungarian Revolution of 1918, which was not yet an orthodox revolution. And secondly, in the Hungarian Revolution of 1957. Which was, of course, the famous uprising against Stalinism. Both times, Lukács was the Hungarian Minister of Culture. He was never easy in his orthodoxy. He was always regarded with suspicion because of history and class consciousness. To such an extent that though Hungary, as you may know, is the most liberal of the East European countries, his disciples have just been driven from Hungary, and are now, as a matter of fact, mostly in Australia, but they have been driven from Hungary because still Bolshevism cannot stand the thought of history and class consciousness, no more than it could stand the thought of Bloch, or than it could stand the thought of the Kantian socialist. Now, Lukács has lasted longer because he is more complex. Because in a sense he accepts more of the rationalism and the reason and the scientism of Marxism than either Bloch, who seems to give it up altogether, or the Kantian socialist. For as Lukács in 1922 sees it, we must leave the iron cage of dogma. And it is typical that Lukács was a convert to Marxism. Before the First World War, he was a kind of German idealist, a neo-romantic. He was a convert, a young Jew who became a convert to Marxism. So he said, we must get out of the iron cage. But what is the problem? What is the problem? His definition of the problem is really what is of crucial importance. It coined a new word, and it had a lasting significance. For what Lukács says is very simple, really, basically, that the problem today in 1922, after the war, the problem is that we are caught between two forces, between alienation. Well, there's no problem about that. That comes from Hegel. Marx had written about it, alienation. You all know what that is. You all think you're alienated from something. So, but the other word is much more difficult. Now listen very closely, because I must go back for a minute to Marx. Marx had written some famous passage that under capitalism everything becomes an object, which he called the fetishism of goods. He said under capitalism, if you look at some jewelry, you don't look at its beauty, you look at its financial values. Everything becomes a good, everything a piece of goods, everything becomes an object. There is no more any aesthetic. You judge everything by its price. What that means is that everything becomes, as Marx put it, and I must repeat the phrase, a fetishism of goods. You make a fetish out of goods. Everything is a good. Everything is for sale, right? Therefore, there is no beauty. This is one of Marx's main points. There is no beauty in the world, because when you look at a beautiful thing, it is fetishized as good. Lukács took it one step further. He said, one of the problems is that not only we are alienated, but everything in life seems to us an object. Nothing in life seems to us, let us say, anything else but a mere object. A mere object. Now, you already had that with the futurists. Remember when I talked about the painting of De Chirico, which I hope you have seen by now in the Elbe Museum, or you should see now, because De Chirico was to express the same thing earlier. That is to say, in Chirico's painting, everything becomes an object. There are no living human beings. They're only objects. They are no beauty, they are only objects. So this wasn't only Lukács' affair. But Lukács believed that under capitalism, whatever you see becomes an object. Even if you see a beautiful woman, in reality, you are so corrupt under capitalism that she is, her beauty is an important, she is an object. She is a thing to you. She isn't anything living. She is a thing to you, a thing that can be bought and sold, if you want to put it that way. If you look at jewelry, if you look at the mountain, These things are not living things, not things that have a soul, not things that are alive. They are objects. And so he coined a famous word, though I hate to give you words, they do not hear me, but I have a feeling that if undergraduates today want to prove they're in the swing of intellectual life, they sit in their dormitories and talk about reification. This is called reification. The German is much better, but we have a handicap here. English is a terrible language for philosophy, because obviously English is the language of pragmatists. So English is a very unsuitable language for any subtlety of expression. I mean it seriously. So the German word for Verdinglichung is a much better word, because in German it means that making an object more dense, or making the object more dense, Verdinglichung. In other words, I'm just saying something that is clear to all of you. If you want to know what the world is about, you have to learn German, because otherwise you can never express it. What you have therefore here is clear. You have an idea of reification. The result is that the main accusation against capitalism is that capitalism leads to reification. Now, you have a question on that, or are you sure what I mean by reification? Because everything now depends on that. Yes? Because man is in between alienation and reification. Yes, you have a question. Are you sure you know what it means? It's not easy to explain, but it means that everything that you look at under capitalism is deprived of a soul. It's deprived of personality. It's deprived, and now I use a Lukács word, of individual consciousness. It's deprived of individual consciousness. Because it's objectified, it's thingified. That might be a better word, but I better use the word everybody uses. Why is that so? And here Lukács goes to Max Weber. It is so because under capitalism everything is rationalized. Now that shouldn't be difficult to understand, it makes it easier for you. If, as Max Weber had already said, capitalism means rationalization, bureaucracy, rationalization, then capitalism means depersonalization. Because to rationalize everything is, of course, to depersonalize everything. And to depersonalize everything means to reify everything. Yes? So you can see how Lukács would start with the idea of the rationalization of labor. The rationalization of labor in high capitalism is a typical process which fragments life. Marx had already said. Therefore, rationalization of labor leads to alienation. Well, all you have to do there is to look at that hole in the union where you put your plates and see the people who work on the other side. That's how Marx looked at the industrial process. So, rationalization leads to fragmentation and alienation. But rationalization also leads to reification. When you understand that, you understand Lukács' critique of capitalism. Then you understand the critique of capitalism, which in a sense has lasted, and which is still at the basis of all of these discussions today. That is the basis. Now, if that is so, how do men understand the world? It's their hope. Yes, there is hope. Because what man has to do is to recapture his consciousness. He can recapture his consciousness if he understands what I've just said. If he understands the totality of the corruption of capitalism. Then man can recapture his consciousness, and through recapture his consciousness, further the class struggle. In other words, in a sense, and I'll come back to that one, the solution is to try and grasp the evil of capitalism in its totality. I'll come back to the meaning of totality. Grasp in its totality. If you do, you will recapture your consciousness. You will understand the meaning of reification, its danger. You will understand why you are alienated. You will become a leader in socialism and in the class struggle. But through recapturing your consciousness, you will also become an individual. In becoming an individual, you will interact with reality. In other words, in the end, we are back with Hegel. The final solution is the Hegelian man. The man who has the consciousness to understand the present stage of history. And who, because he understands it, interacts with reality and lifts reality to a higher plane. That is, after all, I must repeat this, the rhythm of Hegel. This is the Hegelian man, yes? This is the Hegelian man. And for Luca, this is the solution. That is why, in present Marxism, the emphasis is so much on right consciousness and wrong consciousness. If you see capitalism only partially, only as oppressing the workers, or only in your own factory, or only as a kind of tactic, then you do not see the totality. Or if you are a capitalist yourself, then you have false consciousness. The task of socialism is to transform true false consciousness into true consciousness. Now, here you see the essence of Lukács, yes? And I want you to think about it, because you may have questions, and you have to follow this as I go on logically. Man is between alienation and reification. Man has to recapture his consciousness. He can only recapture his consciousness if he sees the totality of capitalism and the totality of oppression, if he understands reification and alienation. From out of this totality, you will come to understanding, to cognition, to understanding. And that understanding will interact with reality. You will become a leader in the class struggle. And reality will interact with your true consciousness, and therefore you fuse, as it were, individualism and society, individualism and the future. I'll go on with that next time, but please, if I'll stop again at the beginning, and I would be very happy if you have any questions. Please. Now, what I want to do today, very rapidly, is I want to talk about the Brecht, to sum it up very briefly, because I think the Brecht